From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you'll call this number now, 1-800-462-7413. Of course, along with your calls, Zorba, some topics to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about the low-carb diet, its advantages, and what new research shows about it. It's a diet that I think is very important to people to think about and talk about.
Mm-hmm. And?
Heart failure drug. New heart failure drug holds great promise in the future. Heart failure is always in the top five leading causes of death for people over the age of 60. This drug is going to help quite a bit.
Okay, and a recipe.
Thai beef salad, and we call it the quickie Thai beef salad because it's quick to do, quick to make, and delish.
Even I could do it?
Even Tom can do it. Yes, there we go. We'll call it Tom's quickie Thai beef salad. How does that sound?
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, our first caller, is on the phone with us now, a listener in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you all so much for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I'm 25 years old, very active, grew up playing sports, and about 3 years ago, after doing a lot of long road trips and driving during the summer, I just felt this really sharp pain and soreness in my rear end just on one side, and I got out and stretched and walked around and tried to loosen it up, but just kind of kept really feeling sore. And basically since then, in the past 3 years, it's just any time that I sit for like longer than 30 minutes, and especially driving, it gets really sore there.
Wow.
Didn't know if it was a sciatic nerve issue or something.
So what were you doing at the time?
I was driving, nothing too active.
Well, sitting in your car, driving. Had you been on a bike recently at all?
I did actually the previous summer bike across the country.
Oh.
But yeah, nothing that summer that would have been that strenuous.
So wait, let me get this
wait
straight.
A minute, you biked
across the country?
Yes.
That's rather strenuous. That is a lot. How long did that take?
It was about 9 weeks.
Wow.
Tom and I are blown away sitting here thinking that you biked across the country, A, and that you did it in nine weeks.
That's
quite
amazing.
A lot. But you knew your butt never hurt you during that time.
Yeah, during that time, nothing was wrong, and really wasn't until a year later that just, I guess, sitting for a long time and driving really aggravated it.
What makes your butt worse, and what makes your butt better?
Really just sitting, especially while in a car seat, seems to aggravate it the most. But even, I mean, I'm in graduate school now, and even sitting, you know, for a long time in the library will start hurting.
What's a long time in the library?
An hour or more.
Okay. Well, first of all, buttock pain is not uncommon. I mean, it actually is common, and it can be due to a variety of things. Sitting, you know, if you told me it was after your bike ride, I would say, what's the trauma of riding across the country? That would make some sense. But you were in a car. So clearly something happened there. Sometimes we will image that buttock. In other words, we will do a CT scan to see if there is a hematoma, a collection of blood in that buttock for some reason, because you want to have an explanation. Other times we'll just do an X-ray to see if there's anything going on with the bone in your buttock. Most of the time, these are negative. We don't find anything. And what we find is that by changing how we sit, it can make a difference over time. So, for instance, not sitting on a hard seat, number one. Number two, putting a pillow under your thigh when you're sitting to raise your legs somewhat, so under the upper part of the thigh, so you're actually putting weight differently on your buttock, that can make a difference, especially when you're sitting in the car. In other words, leaning back, putting something like a little roller pillow under your legs with that. If you're sitting for a long period of time in the library, that's, you know, where we're sitting pushing pain on there because you have something, a muscle or a ligament or a nerve that you're putting on, and you're probably continuing to put it on because you're a graduate student, and graduate students sit all the time. It's hard to have a standing desk when you're doing graduate work. So what you want to do is get the right kind of a cushion, and often the best cushion is a cushion they have at medical supply houses for hemorrhoids, which is a donut cushion. A little donut looks just like a donut or a little beach, you know, whatever you call those things that look like donuts. And then you sit differently within it, so you're not putting pressure on your buttock. You're putting pressure essentially on your leg and your back when you're sitting down. And I would recommend getting one of those cushions because I think you're continuing to aggravate some sort of a hematoma, collection of blood, that probably spontaneously developed in your buttock. And these are very difficult things to diagnose. I have a guy who developed buttock pain, and it took a long time. Actually, it took a couple of years before it went away. We did a whole bunch of imaging. We never found out what it was, but he kept from sitting in a painful way. In other words, by using these cushions, and eventually it just disappeared. So get a donut cushion. Do not sit on a hard chair. Raise your thighs. And the other thing you might want to do is, you know, you're in graduate school. You probably have reasonable insurance. Is go to physical therapy and get some stretching exercises for your buttock. Physical therapists are awesome with that, and they will give you some butt stretching exercises. People don't realize that it is the largest muscle in the body. The gluteus maximus and gluteus medius and minimus are also quite large. You need stretching exercises for your butt.
Okay.
And this should be easy for you. Stay out of the car. Just bike everywhere.
Yeah, I've been trying. I mean, that's the bright side is I never sit for too long. I'm always up and on my feet.
Good for you.
There, yeah, across the country in how, you know, that period of time is like unbelievable. So,
It was, it was quite an adventure. Beautiful way to see the country, for
I bet. Well, let us know what happens and send us some photos. If you send us some photos of your trip, we'll put it up on our website, zorbapastor.org.
I will.
Yeah, hey, send us some photos. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Yep. I appreciate all your advice.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. 800-462-7413, toll-free. And Zorba, you say you have some research comparing a low-fat and a low-carb diet.
Yeah, low-carb diets. Everyone knows what low-carb diets are. Do you know what a low-carb diet is?
No, I don't, actually.
Yeah, well, it's because you're not on a diet.
Right.
If you're on a
diet, I know what a low-fat diet is.
I know, but if you're one of the people who dieted, you would know what low-carb. Well, Dr. Atkins popularized the low-carb diet. Just
eat a lot
eat
of meat,
fat.
That was his.
Yeah, eat bacon and, you know, cheese and have all the steak you want to. Remember, he died of cardiovascular complications, and he was obese at the time of his death. So I just want to state that. But since that time, there are a variety of diets that are low carb. The South Beach diet, which is a far better diet, is low carb. But the issue with doctors not jumping on the low carb bandwagon, because by definition, if you're eating fewer carbohydrates, you're going to eat more fat.
Yeah.
Kind of by definition.
Well, that's a stupid question, but what kind of foods are we talking about?
Well, if you're having low carbs, it means you're having maybe the equivalent of 3 to 4 slices of bread a day. That is a low-carb diet, okay? In pasta or anything else that is carbohydrates, you're eating mostly fat. That's what you're eating. You're eating more fish, you may be eating more seafood, you may be eating beef, but it's more fat. That's what we're talking about. It's not pasta, it's not bread, it's not carbohydrates. Okay, so they wanted to look at cholesterol numbers.
Yeah.
In other words,
well, I don't think...
Yeah.
I said the low carb. What foods are low in carbs?
So bacon.
Are low in carbs?
Poultry.
Well, I thought that would be high fat
cheese.
Stuff.
These are high fat stuff. Therefore, they're low in carb. Anything that is high fat is low in carb.
Okay, thank
anything
you.
Anything that's high fat is low carb. Okay. A carbohydrate would be a potato, would be a sugar. Is a carbohydrate, would be bread, would be bagels, would be pasta.
Okay.
It's actually the mainstay. The American Heart Association has said we need to have a low-fat diet, only 30% of your calories coming from fat. Therefore, stay away from cheese. Stay away from beef, which we still should. Eat too much beef. Stay away from anything that has fat in it, only 30%. Mm-hmm. The theory is that a low-fat diet will produce less cardiovascular complications. Now, keep in mind, this comes from the 50s, when we were eating meat and potatoes and bacon and eggs every single day, which, you know, you've got to look at that history.
Right.
So they wanted to look at the cholesterol numbers in the low-carb diet and the low-fat diet.
Okay.
American Heart Association low-fat diet, the low-carb diet that the Heart Association does not say is good. Mm-hmm. The cholesterol numbers were better in the low-carb diet than in the American Heart Association low-fat diet.
Wow.
Wow, that's exactly right. These were 200 people followed in a real-life situation. They were measured at 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months. They looked at weight loss. The people on the low-carb diet lost more weight. Everyone tended to lose weight because they're on a diet and they're motivated. When you're on a study, you're motivated.
Yeah.
The low-carb diet people lost 8 pounds more. 8 pounds is quite a bit. Might not seem like a lot if you don't want to lose weight, but it may allow you to get into that dress for your daughter's wedding.
Right.
And so that's a lot. So the low-carb diet people also had better cholesterol numbers than the American Heart Association low-fat diet people. Their HDL or good cholesterol went up. Their ratio of the good cholesterol to the total cholesterol improved, and their Framingham risk score, which takes into consideration blood pressure, smoking, and cholesterol, improved. It didn't change on the American Heart Association low-fat diet, but it improved on the low-carb diet.
So Atkins was right?
Hard to believe, isn't it, that Atkins was right? Exactly. I have not thought Atkins is right.
Now, you've been poo-pooing Atkins.
Right. Yeah. Could I be wrong? Dr. Zorba Pastor possibly make a mistake? I don't think so. No, we've got to take it into context.
Yeah.
So Atkins said, eat all the fat you want, including beef fat and bacon and stuff like that. I'm not on that part. I think we eat too much animal fat. I think this shows that we're eating too many carbohydrates. I think that's what it shows. I think it shows that a low-carb diet is healthy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a one-year study. Now, the cardiologists-to-be, some of them will disagree with me, and they always disagree, and they go, well, you know, we believe the American Heart Association diet works. It's kind of like a religion. You've been saying it for years. Come on, get a life. The Mediterranean diet is a great diet, and the Mediterranean diet is basically a low-carb type diet.
It's also low-fat.
No, it is not. It has different fat. It has cheese in it. It has fish, which also have salmon in it.
Yep.
It has lean cuts of poultry, which has some fat in it. It does not have a lot of red meat. It may have a little red meat for that. And remember, 2 years ago, the 7,000-person study showed the Mediterranean diet people had 30% fewer calories. Now, one little caveat to this. Last spring, unfortunately, I had to go on a Wisconsin Public Radio trip to Paris and to France.
I felt so sorry for you while I was sitting here in wonderful Wisconsin and you were off there.
You were sitting in cold weather and rain and sleet and snow. And unfortunately, I was in France eating food that was wonderful. I'm sitting next to this wonderful, wonderful guy, wonderful people who's on an American Heart Association low-fat diet.
Yeah.
And he said, how can this be good for me? My doctor would never allow me to have this. We're sitting there and we have a little bit of cheese and we've got some wonderful fish and we've got a little bit of pasta. Not a lot of pasta. Remember, low carb doesn't mean no carb.
Right.
It means low carb.
Yeah.
And then we're having some wonderful other food. And he goes, this food is delicious, but it doesn't fit with the diet my doctor put me on. He would never let me be on it. And I said, welcome to the Mediterranean diet. It's healthy. He said, I think my numbers will be awful when I get home.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he thought. The answer was his numbers probably were better.
Yeah. Can I do a quick nitpick before we get back to the
phone?
This was 200 people, right?
Yes, it was only 200 people. No, it's not a nitpick. We don't change something for one study, but I think this reinforces the Mediterranean diet study, which was 7,000 people. Because the Mediterranean diet is a variation of a low-carb diet, and that study is the massive study that really counts.
Yeah.
And that study really shows that too many carbohydrates put on the weight are not satisfying and are bad for your lipids.
1-800-462-7413. And, Zorba, we go to a Lakeview, New York listener now. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, how Pleasure. Can we help?
My question for you, Zorba, was about aspartame. I was wondering what your thoughts on aspartame was and if you agree with some of the internet lore that it's bad for you. I've gotten an argument with my stepdad, who is he's a teacher, earth science teacher, and he keeps telling me that there's nothing wrong with it, and he's read all the studies, and anyway, what have you found?
So let's talk a little bit about aspartame and what it is. And I recently wrote an article about aspartame. We put it on the website on our Facebook page, and I was just looking at the Facebook page. We've got more response to the aspartame article. I'm sure that Carl noticed that, my producer, than we had for any recent articles about it. So let's look at aspartame. Aspartame, when the body metabolizes, it goes into two amino acids plus something else. We'll talk about the something else. Amino acids are okay for us. They're safe for us. One is, but except if you have phenylketonuria, you cannot actually metabolize that amino acid. And so on every aspartame can, it says, if you have phenylketonuria, do not take this. This is aspartame. So amino acids are fine. They're metabolized in the body. They're nothing. But it also releases methanol. And methanol in large doses can be a toxin, and it's the methanol that the feds and other people have looked at. Now, aspartame is the most studied supplement in the world ever at any time. It's been around for a huge amount of time. There are a lot of websites devoted to aspartame. You know, to put up a website doesn't cost you much. It's like $10-$20 a month, and you can put up a very pretty anti-aspartame website and cite lots of data. But the feds looked at aspartame about 4 or 5 years ago, and there was a study that came out of Europe that showed that mice that had lots of aspartame had cancer. So the FDA said, okay, you've shown these mice have cancer. It was either mice or rats, can't quite remember. Give us the data, because we want to see what, you know, whether or not there's real cancer. So the organization that did it sent some slides to the FDA. The FDA reviewed the slides and said, we don't see cancer here. Send us all your data so we can review it. And they refused to do it. They refused to send the slides. They refused to send all the data for the studies. Then the FDA went back and said, well, we'll look at an independent European commission made up of experts to look at the data. And the organization that did it, the academic institution, shut them off. They said, sorry, we don't have the data. They gave some excuse. And so the FDA closed the case. In other words, and I think they closed the case clearly because they were stonewalling on the data, and you can decide whether or not the data was real or not. I feel that if your data isn't open, there's some reason it's not open, you know. And the reason may be pecuniary, you want money, or maybe you're just looking to make yourself, you know, famous, or some other reason, goofy reason that people do. But if you don't share the data, then it's not scientifically based, then you must assume the data is not real. So that's the biggest data that's there. So the feds have looked at it. The feds have said it's generally recognized as safe. I think it's safe as a lot of other things in our society. That's where I put it. Now, given that, aspartame has never been shown to improve weight loss. People who drink diet soda are overweight, and they don't lose weight. They continue to be overweight. They guzzle the soda, and they continue to be overweight. And maybe it's because aspartame stimulates appetite. That is a real possibility. Diet soda, when you drink it, may stimulate something in your satiety center and say, I need more calories, and you get them somewhere else. Because diet soda, the more we drink, the heavier we get. Does that help you?
Yes, it does. That's really interesting to hear that the study and how it was. Seems like there's some sort of money interest.
Might be money. Might just be notoriety. Mm-hmm. People like to do things so they can become famous and give lectures and look like they're the big person. Mm-hmm. You know, look what they found out. But if they don't share the data, I assume the data is faked. That's my assumption. Show me the money. If you don't show me the money, it ain't real.
Thank you, Zorba.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thanks for listening. Good luck.
Yeah. And before the break, Zorba, it's time to hear from your favorite do-gooders, the Grammar Police.
Oh, go, Grammar, go.
And with the Grammar Police comes our brand new theme song, Hit It.
Oh, no, it's the Grammar Police.
I have to admit, I like the tune. It's really good.
Is that a famous singer? I think it's the voice.
Famous singer. I think I've seen his pictures on photos, on cell phone photos in Spain. That's what I think I have. We've got to put his picture up there on the website.
That's right.
That's right.
We'll find it in a magazine.
We will.
Today's infraction is handed out to us courtesy of a listener, Fred, from Providence, Utah. He writes, "Dear Zorba and Tom, the use of the word incredible is ubiquitous and incredibly hackneyed. I consider you a fine example of a principled practitioner of practical and progressive prose, not easy to say, in the explanation of a wide variety of medical conditions. I like your show, even though you once laughed at a practical use of flax seeds to remove stuff from eyes that I shared with you. However, when you said recently that a certain thyroid condition is incredibly curable, it struck a tender chord. Incredibly curable."
You know, we all have styles.
Yeah.
You know, and I have an awesome, hackney, incredible style. I mean, that's it. You know, I'm a function of our society.
I think actually you're right. Doesn't incredible mean almost impossible to believe?
Yes. Yes.
And so, yes. Cannot a thyroid condition be incredibly curable?
Yeah, we
have a cure that is difficult to believe.
You know, I think it's an awesome thing. Awesome, awesome, awesome. Incredible, yeah. Incredible, incredible. Yeah. You know what the issue is in our society?
Yeah.
We use these words over and over again just to sort of for like punchy, you know, it's the punchiness.
Yeah, I think that was an incredibly good email he sent.
Tom, you are incredibly insightful.
He also adds, thanks for your great show. If you'd like to join up, the Grammar Police is always looking for new recruits. Just send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or Facebook.
We have a really good recipe coming up, I think. Sounds like I'll like it. More of your emails, of course, our medical myth buster, and of course, more of your calls, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But before we take our next call, recipe time, this one, Zorba, quickie Thai beef salad.
That's right, quickie Thai beef salad. You know, quickie in our society means other things. I know you would be shocked by it.
Let's get back to the recipe.
You know, you've got to have a name that at least has some nuance to it. But in this case, quickie means that you can do it quickly.
In a hurry.
Yeah, but if we said quickly Thai beef salad, that just wouldn't sound good. So quickie sounds much better. But this is something you can throw together. One of the things I like about some easy recipes are it's things you can do at lunchtime. You can do it at lunchtime, at your office, something like that, or you can do it at home at lunchtime, and you can throw it together. We could call this Throw It Together Quickly Thai Beef Salad.
Okay.
It's a quickie recipe that you will like. You like Thai food, Tom, don't you?
Doing this recipe is going to be quicker than this lead up to
all right, recipe. All right. I got it. Yeah. Start out with two limes.
Two limes.
3 tablespoons of low-sodium fish sauce.
3 big T low-sodium fish sauce.
Now, the nice thing about fish sauce is it adds, if you're using it instead of salt, for instance, even low-sodium salty.
I don't even know what fish sauce
it's used, is. It's used in small amounts in Thai cooking.
Oh, okay.
So you know what it tastes like, even though I can't describe it, because when you think about like pad Thai and you think about some of that taste is fish sauce.
Got it.
Is what it is. 1 tablespoonful of sugar.
Big tea sugar.
10-ounce bag of romaine salad mix. Remember, this is quickie, no work.
Yeah. 10-ounce bag, romaine salad mix.
1 medium seedless cucumber thinly sliced.
A medium seedless cucumber thinly sliced.
8 ounces of deli sliced roast beef. Now, if you want to, you could make a deli-sized turkey. You can make a deli-sized chicken. Yeah. But it's 8 ounces of a protein, an animal protein that you like, cut into 1/2-inch strips.
Got it.
A cup of fresh cilantro. If you are one of the group of non-cilantro lovers, use a cup of parsley.
Okay, cup of fresh cilantro or parsley.
1/2 medium red onion thinly sliced.
1/2 a medium red onion thinly sliced.
Let's make it. Start out by zesting 1 lime. Limes are really easy to zest. And then squeeze out the juice. And you're going to end up with 3 tablespoonfuls of lime juice and the zest of the lime. Then in a small bowl, prepare the dressing. Combine the zested lime and the juice and the fish sauce and the sugar and stir until the sugar is completely dissolved. Then in a large bowl, combine the romaine salad mix, sliced cucumber, roast beef or chicken or turkey if you want to, cilantro or parsley, and the onion. And you put it all together, and it's delicious.
Yeah.
Add it to the bowl, dress it up, and combine it. The fish sauce gives it that Thai flavor. The lime is also a flavor of a lot of South Asian cuisines.
This sounds great. And you're okay with a bag of lettuce?
Yeah, absolutely. I do it sometimes. I buy bags of bag. I don't do it that often, but I buy it. You know, I often buy it with actually salad mixes, you know, that are the salad mixes that don't have romaine. But I'm ready for it. 150 calories. This is a low-fat, high-protein dish. And when you look at it from a point of view of the protein, it's about 30, about a third of the protein that you need for the entire day. It's crunchy and it's good.
I'm going to go to the computer and find out how
You know what? You know what you do? If you go to ZorbaPastor.org, you can find this. And you know what, Tom? If you know how to turn on a computer, you can go to it. Absolutely. And you know what? If you're turning on a computer, I'm taking a photo and putting it on the Facebook page, because that's where people can come and find this too.
1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, we welcome a listener in Niagara Falls in Canada. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Thank you for taking my call. I have a medical, I don't even know if it's a medical term, but I have what I'm, what they call lipoma lumps or bumps. And my sister has a very severe case of them. They did operate some of them, but they come back. And it's they're like fat lumps. I don't know how to describe them. They start small, and they increase as time goes by. And I was just wondering, they do not like to operate on them because they come back. I wondered if there was some kind of a solution, because I know Dr. Zorba has solutions.
To everything.
To everything, that's right.
I thought even I've been massaging them. I have them on my forearm. I was told by my regular doctor, my GP, not to worry about them.
Right.
But they increase in size after a while. My sister's got as big as, I would say, an orange.
Right. They
and
actually can
they
be
look
quite
ugly.
Big. Yeah, that is true. You know, I wish I had a solution, especially after that really nice compliment. Some people, like you say, in your family develop lipomas, and lipomas are fat tissue. And instead of growing in a sheet, so they sort of cover us and make us look bigger because it's fat, they grow in these little bubbles, and they do tend to come back. And one of the reasons we don't like to remove them is they tend to come back. And, you know, what happens is people who have a lot of them can end up with a lot of scars and then end up having lipomas that come back. But the big ones, or the ones that are painful, often we do have to take off. And and they run in families, and I wish that I had something that I could give you that would stop the lipomas. Have you had any removed at all?
No, I have not. I wasn't too concerned about it. Yeah. I mean, I also say that I'm already 71, so I figured, well, what the heck, you know, you grow little bumps here and there, not to worry. But when I saw what was happening to my sister, then that became a worry, that's all.
Oh, sure.
And hers are increasingly getting bigger.
Right.
And even the operated ones came back. But the thing is, I was just wondering if massaging them, there's very little information on lipoma?
I wish the answer was you could massage them away. You can't. There's no food that does it. If you've got one that's painful, but I think you've actually, and your GP said just exactly what I tell patients. Don't worry about it, meaning it's not going to become cancer. And unless it's really painful, and often just that reassurance helps people. Lots of people have lipomas. It's very common. The big ones are not that common, and if they're too big and unsightly, then often you have to get them removed. Wish I had something to help your sister, but from your point of view, not to worry.
There you go. Not to worry.
Exactly.
Thank you. I'm not going to worry.
There.
Great. That's
sure there's worse things out there that I could worry about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much for your call.
We appreciate
I had the answer. Not to worry.
There you go. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, to a listener in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. How you doing?
Good, good. Thank you. How can we help you?
Well, a few months ago, I went down to Mexico near Tulum, and I was there for 1 week. Within the 3 days of being there, my legs swelled up and were completely red. And I was wondering how, if I go down in that area again, how I can avoid having this inflammation come back.
Uh-huh.
I don't exactly know what happened. I know it wasn't cellulitis, but if you could help me, that would be great.
Sure. So when you got off the airplane, were your legs swollen?
No, not at all.
Okay, so you got off the airplane. It wasn't an in-flight issue. Legs swell in the airplane. When people don't move around, their legs swell. So you got to Tulum, which is beautiful. I've been there years ago.
Oh,
and when did
90 degrees.
Oh, yeah. It's warm. It's wonderful in the middle of wintertime. Having leg swelling would be awful. How long were you there before your leg swelled?
It was, we got there on a Sunday, and by Tuesday evening, my legs were beet red and inflamed.
Hmm. Were you in the sun?
I did not get it from sunburn. I had sunscreen on the whole time.
What do you think it was? You think it was from the water? Was it something you touched? Do you have any other insight as to what it might have been?
I don't know. I walked across the grass, and sometimes, my feet did not get it. I had sneakers on, and it just was from my ankles up to my knee.
Okay.
On both legs.
So
I thought maybe it was a heat rash or something.
Well, let's put this together for a second. So it's not from the sun. In other words, if it's a drug-related rash, often your whole body will get it. So, for instance, if you're on tetracycline or doxycycline, which is an antibiotic, which commonly causes a rash in the sun, the whole body, the body will develop the rash. So you have something. You did not have that. So we can kind of rule that out. And as you said, you wore sunscreen. You walked through grass from the knee to the ankle. It didn't occur below the ankle where you had socks on and you had a shoe. Occurred there. Sounds like it's a contact dermatitis. Sounds like it was related to probably something in those grasses that you walked through. That's what it most likely was from. Mm-hmm. It was probably a contact dermatitis. So I would go down there, and what I would do is I wouldn't walk through the – if you're going to go back to the same resort area, I wouldn't walk through the grass unless I had pants on. In other words, I wouldn't walk in with, with a swimsuit or shorts.
Well, the grass wasn't long. It was all – manicured and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I thought maybe it was a heat rash or something.
I don't. It sounds to me if it's between the ankles and the knees. First of all, if you have, quote, a heat rash, prickly heat, which we all got as babies, or as you know, that's kind of different. Once again, that's from the heat. It's a total body rash. It's often not from the knee to the ankles. There's something that happened from the knee to the ankles, I think, that you touched or came into contact with. Now, a manicured lawn is not a pristine lawn. A manicured lawn has chemicals on it to keep it manicured. A natural lawn has dandelions and weeds and other things, and people don't like that. They want it to look like Disney World. And Disney World, as we know, is an artificial place. So when you walk through that manicured lawn, it might have had a chemical on it, not necessarily a weed, that then somehow got on between your ankle and your knees that produced this.
Wow.
That's what I would look for.
Stay off the grass.
Yeah, stay off the grass, or Or if you're going to be on the grass, wear something, you know, wear a long, you know, wear pants instead of wearing shorts. But my first thought would be it's the grass. That's what I would think. It was something on the grass that actually did it. And so I would, yeah, I would stay off the grass. That's what I would do. And,
okay.
And see what happens. Yeah. So you're going back
all
there?
Right.
You're going back to Tulum?
No, Roatan down in Honduras next year.
Wonderful.
So,
it sounds great. Stay safe.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take a quick email question from Chuck in Spokane, Washington. He writes, Dear Zorba, first off, I love your radio show. My question is this. I have chronic lower back pain due to 5 bulging discs, 2 herniated discs, and a fractured vertebra.
Wow.
Which specialist would be better to do the surgery, an orthopedic surgeon or a neurosurgeon?
Well, the answer is both. The answer is both. What you want to do is go to somebody who has lots of experience with this type of surgery. And neurosurgeons do this surgery. Orthopedic surgeons do the surgery. One is not better than another. Mm-hmm. A lot of orthopedic surgeons have gone into spine surgery and are specialized in that. A lot of neurosurgeons, their bread and butter is spine surgery, and they specialize in that. They're both good at doing this. Within our medical group, we had an orthopedic surgeon who did lots of back surgery. We have a number of neurosurgeons. They do back surgery. I often send them to the surgeon who I think is best for that, and I think it's the surgical skill that matters.
Just so we don't scare the guy, when you said go to both, you didn't mean he had to have 2
surgeons. Oh, No. I mean both were the correct answer.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not one. And I mean, you're right. No, he doesn't need 2. It's not one versus another. It's who does a lot. And some of them will say, yeah, I like complicated spines. I'm used to doing this. So it's a matter of who you place your trust in.
Need some healthy living advice from the good doc? Post your question to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some interesting research to talk over. That's coming up next. More of your calls, our medical myth buster. Lots of good reasons for you to stick around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, this one, as you know, has gotten so much attention lately, a new drug for heart disease.
Heart failure.
Heart failure.
Specifically.
Yeah.
So let's look at what heart failure is. So heart failure is the inability for the heart to keep up with its metabolic needs. And what happens is if you've got recurrent heart attacks, we'll say little bits of the heart muscle die over time. The heart muscle then dilates because it's not really functioning that well. And eventually you go into a cycle where the heart muscle gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And it's one of the top 5 leading causes of death over the age of 65. So it's a great big issue. Lots of people die of heart failure. The mainstay of heart failure for years has been something called an ACE inhibitor. An ACE inhibitor is a blood pressure pill that is a mainstay of basically making the heart better, and we actually live longer from it. Heart failure and ACE inhibitors and diuretics.
Yeah.
This study is of a new drug made by Novartis, which looks like it's really going to make a major difference. It's the first new drug that seems to make a difference in heart failure. It's a big study. 8,500 people in nearly 50 countries followed a bunch of the people. A number of the people got the older drug, the ACE inhibitor that's been around forever. The other people got the new drug, and there was a significant drop. If we look at heart-related causes of death, it was a drop of 20%. because of people on this drug. And if we look at the crude death rate from everything, a drop of 16%, dropped the hospitalization rate by 20%. That's a biggie. The hospitalization, these people with heart failure are hospitalized over and over and over again, and that's a biggie. Now, if you look at the absolute numbers, there still are lots of deaths from heart failure. If we look at the ACE inhibitor group, heart-related deaths, 26.5% in that group. If we look at the new drug, 22% still died. So there's still a lot of deaths from heart failure. Yeah. But you're looking at a huge number of people with heart failure who may be helped. And this percentage difference can really make a difference for them.
What's this thing called?
Well, it's got a name. I think it's called Novel, N-O-V-E-L. It's not on the market yet. It's going to be on the market. You know, it'll be on the market probably within the next 6 months.
Isn't this one of those things where they stopped the study in the middle?
Well, they stopped the study in the middle because they saw a difference. What happens is, on studies like that, they have an independent group that monitors the safety. They want to see, is one group better than another group? It's a double-blind study. The independent group doesn't talk to the statisticians or anyone else. There's a wall between them. And if they find that one group in the study is doing better than another group, they will stop the study. And this was dramatic enough, so they stopped the study early because the new drug was different than the older drug. So I think for people with heart failure, this is a boon.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, back to the phones we go. A listener in Springfield, Missouri with us now. Hi.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Zorba. I had my knee replaced. I went to PT after that, and when I saw the doc, he wasn't happy, so I got it manipulated about 2 months after that. I then went to PT again, and somehow I'm not getting the result that I was hoping I would get, and the problem is that I can get on a stationary bike and stretch the knee, or at least get it flexible to the point where it's comfortable. But if I get off the bike and get on the bike again about 15 minutes later, then it's like starting over. The knee is stiff again. I've lost that flexibility. I can now ride a bike, which was one of the goals I had to get the knee replaced. Yeah, I can get on my bicycle, and after about 5 minutes, it feels good.
Okay.
Let me put it that way.
Okay, so it takes about 5 minutes of range of motion on the stationary bike inside your house, right? Is that what you're
right.
That's what you're using. Okay, there are a few things about knees. You hit on some major points. One of the problems with knee replacement, hip replacement is relatively simple in terms of the ability to recover range of motion, pain and discomfort. People, the hip socket just recovers better. It's a bigger socket, but the joint is actually a different joint than the knee joint. Knee joints are a problem in that if you don't get the flexibility back pretty much within those first 2 to 4 to 6 weeks, you're just hanging on for a long period of time. And some people get it back quicker. Some people do not get it back. And working really hard with physical therapy immediately after the surgery helps. But still, there are a group of people. It's a significant group. I don't know if it's 10% or 20%, but it's a significant number who say, it just takes me a while to get the flexibility. Now, you're 7 months post-op. I believe that healing for a major surgery takes 1 to 2 years. I think you get a lot back in that first 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 1 year, but I believe it's really 2 years before your body fully recovers. The real issue is doing the stretching that you do in the morning. If you're uncomfortable, I would take, if you can tolerate it, 1 or 2 Aleve tablets. It's an anti-inflammatory, before I went to sleep at night, so my knee was more flexible in the morning, and I would do what you're doing. I would say, I've got to get up and do my flex exercises. That's what I would do. So you're doing the right thing. You may need to take a little anti-inflammatory to get you better, and you're still in a healing plateau. You still have a good chance your knee is going to heal. You just have to continue to work on it. That's what
you
want to do. You want to get on top of the curve. You're welcome. Good luck. Let us know what happens.
All right. We'll do that.
Thanks.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, time again for our Medical Mythbuster segment. Today's question comes to us from Donna, who's listening in Glenwood City, Wisconsin. She writes, Hello, Dr. Zorba. Some years ago, my father told me if you knew you were touching a poisonous plant, such as poison ivy, nettles, or oak, you wouldn't be affected by it. We happen to have poison nettles in the woods in my backyard, and when I intentionally touch it, it does not affect me whatsoever. Could this be true? Is this mind over matter? You're chuckling.
I'm chuckling. This is not true. It is not mind over matter. It is absolutely not the case. It is a chemical response from your skin. So in other words, it's sort of like if I think that I'm touching poison ivy, I won't get poison ivy. I think if I gave people that advice, I'd be run out of town on a rail. That's definitely myth. Now, sometimes there's some people who are only mildly responsive to poison ivy, poison oak, or the other. But no. I don't think that
I've
is
I've told
the case.
You this one before, but I'll tell it again because I think it's a funny story. When I was a little kid vacationing in the North Woods with my cousins, we had poison ivy around, and I was going to play a real good joke on them. So I carefully pulled out poison ivy by the stem, not touching the leaves, and chased around after my cousins, threatening to put the leaves on them so they'd get the – guess who got the poison ivy? What a dope.
What a dope.
Have a myth for Zorba? Well, he's just itching to bust it.
Oh,
just
I love it.
Send it along in an email to
Zorba at WPR.org or through Facebook.
Back to the phones now, Zorba. We welcome a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. My problem is that I can hear my heart rate pulse in my head. The sensation is constant. I've had this problem for 2 months. I had an ultrasound done of the carotids, and the left carotid is narrowed, and more, which is more prominent in the left than the right. There isn't any treatment recommended at this time. Even though this sensation is constant throughout the day, it's more noticeable when it's quiet because I don't have the daily activities going on.
Let me get a little idea. You went to your doctor. You said, I've got this sensation. I feel my pulse. That's what you said? Is that when you saw your doc?
Well, I had the sensation before I went to the doctor.
Okay. They checked your carotid arteries.
Right.
Not unusual. How old are you?
68.
Okay. They checked your carotid arteries and they said there's some narrowing, but they didn't recommend anything. So, and we all have some narrowing. It's, if you're in your 60s and you've lived, chances are pretty likely you have some narrowing. Some narrowing can be very serious and some isn't. And so they didn't recommend any treatment, meaning that wasn't serious. But I don't really know if this is connected to the heart sensation that you have. Does your heart feel like it's going faster or slower? Tell me a little bit more about that.
Oh, no. You can just hear this swishing sound from, your heart rate and your pulse.
Uh-huh. Is it when you lie down, do you hear it more when you lie on your left side at all?
No. It's constantly the same, whether it's, throughout the day. But like I said, it's more noticeable when it's quiet because
you're quiet.
Right. And you don't have the daily activities occupying your mind.
Yeah, no, you're quiet, and that's pretty common. So, first of all, one of the things you want to do when you have an unusual sensation of the heart is you want to see whether or not the heart is functioning properly. Physical examination helps because you listen to the heart to see whether or not there's a murmur. Many years ago, we'd say if there's a murmur, you might be something serious, but now we can check it out right away with an ultrasound of the heart called an echocardiogram, and that basically tells us whether or not something is significant or not. And I think if you've got an unusual sensation of the heart where you're feeling it, it's probably important for you to get an echocardiogram to see how the valves are working in your heart and maybe a Holter monitor to look at how the heart is actually, what the pulse is like, if you will. But the echocardiogram is where I would go next. Obviously, it's a bothersome sensation. Are you anxious about it? Does it make you anxious?
No, it's just that it's in the head, the sensation. Yeah. I don't really feel it in the heart or anything like that.
So this is more in the head and in the neck,
right,
which is why they initially looked at the carotids. I think I would have an echocardiogram. I would find out what your heart is doing. I think that's what I would do. Because the sound may be going from the heart, may be actually originating from the heart, even though you're experiencing it in your head. So I think an echocardiogram would be something that would be useful for you to have.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Let us know what happens.
Yeah, we appreciate the call at 1-800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And before we head out today, Zorba, let's take an email from a listener named Christopher who has a curious question that may be a bit hard to swallow. He writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I'm a longtime listener and follower of your common sense medical expertise. Talking to friends, I was told to Google the oddest of subjects, oil pulling. The claim is this: scientists in the former Soviet Union, already suspicious, found pulling or swishing oil in one's mouth promotes tooth and gum health. In addition, the study found that toxins from the body and vital organs, including the epidermis, are removed, concentrated, and then spat out the mouth. The procedure takes 15 to 20 minutes using sunflower, sesame, and possibly some other oil.
Oh,
yeah, that kind of oil.
That kind of oil.
Not lubricating.
Not petroleum. I was going to say Russia is simply promoting their petroleum products, and I can't imagine WD-40 swishing around.
No, that other kind of oil. Sesame, sunflower, maybe some others. Have you heard of this? If so, does this work or is this bunk?
So swishing oil around in your mouth. Let me get this straight.
Yeah.
So I might use sesame oil, whatever kind of oil that I want to, and I just swish it around in my mouth for 20 minutes every day, and it's going to remove toxins from my body? Does this sound to you like good science? You know what it sounds to me like? It sounds to me like bunk science. Now, I'm not saying that these Russian scientists aren't real scientists, but this certainly is not scientifically based.
It may not even be been scientists. It may have been just the same kind of bunko people there that we
had. Yeah. You know something? Just like the bunko people they have, we have the same bunko people here. That's exactly
right. Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org or through Facebook.
And don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444, ask for program number 0920Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.